I meet people who have gone down the rabbit hole just as far as I've gone, and they don't do it anymore. And that presents a very compelling picture. And I realize that there is a power out there that some people seem to be able to connect to. And so in step two, I come to believe in this power because I see it bear witness in other people in the rooms. And I go, you're like me, I'm like you, and I want what you got. Show me how to work it. And then I make that decision in step three, where I'm going to fire that liar, that twist of thinking in my head. I'm going to take on a divine consciousness instead. And I'm going to go a different way in life. I'm going to go God's way. I'm not going my way anymore. And I get reborn into a new way of living. And that's a pretty profound decision to make. You know, I sometimes hear in the rooms, oh, don't make any major decisions for the first year. Well, when you think about it, every one of our 12 steps is a major decision. Step one, I'm powerless, I'm unmanageable. Step two, willing to believe in a higher power. Step three, I'm going to fire myself and turn my life over to God as I understand it. Like, those are three big major decisions that we make in our program. So I'm assuming that because you've come back, that those of you who were here yesterday made the decision you want to go this way. And we're just going to reaffirm that commitment with a brief meditation, and then we'll launch into the step four presentation. So if you want to sit in an open body position, straighten your spine, open your hands to receive, and we'll take a short, just a short 3 minute step three affirmative prayer.
If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance. For after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always.
Well, welcome back, everybody. Once again, I'm Cameron. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous and your facilitator on the 12 steps in 4 hours. It only takes a day to learn it and the rest of your life to practice it. For those of you that have been working with others and have an approach of sponsorship, think of this presentation as another tool to add to your toolkit. I kind of think of it like soul surgery, triage work, because sometimes we work with people that are really in crisis. And unless they find a power greater than themselves, chances are they're going to relapse. So we have an opportunity to kind of delve into an expedient process that lets them have a sort of a lick of the ice cream cone of what the God dope is really all about, this spiritual energy, this spiritual dope, and give them a fighting chance. So having done step three, having affirmed the decision that, yes, I'm going to go God's way. I'm not doing it my way anymore. I'm going to hire a divine consciousness and fire that liar that lives in my head that's trying to constantly convince me to go back out. And the first time I ever tried to meditate with this higher power, there was such a cacophony of noise in my head, all those yap-yap voices going off with guilt and shame over the harms I've done and fears and resentments. And I realized that the divine reality is somewhere in there, but I can't seem to connect to it. So I need to do an inventory to remove the blocks, to remove the impediments that block me from having a two-way relationship with the one who has all the power. And this is what step four and five is all about. And it's a process where we get right with ourselves. So as it says at the top of page 12, step four, made a searching and fearless, there's that no half measures again, a searching and fearless moral inventory. A lot of people turn step four into a psychological approach, and that's not what it's about. A 12-step program is a spiritual moral approach to addiction, and what we're doing in our inventory process is uncovering our moral defects, our moral shortcomings. And in this process, we get right with ourselves. So as soon as we've taken our prospect through that all-important step three prayer and affirmation that, yes, I'm going this way, that decision, it says, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. Now, some people try and tell you this means easy, does it? But that's not the way I interpret those words. A course of vigorous action, no half measures. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. And though our decision, the one we just made in step three, it's a vital and crucial step, it's not going to have a permanent effect unless I unblock myself, unless I face and get rid of the things that block me from having this two-way relationship with the one who has all the power. And it requires a strenuous effort. Once again, no half measures. Our liquor, our drugs, our obsessive compulsive behavior, these are symptoms of something deeper down. And so we're going to try and figure out what our causes and conditions are. So we start upon a personal inventory. This is our step four. We take stock of ourselves. Honestly, remember the three essentials, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. First, we search out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure, and being convinced of self manifested in various ways is what had defeated us. We consider its common manifestations. And we look at three manifestations. We look at resentments, we look at our fears, and we look at our harms done to others. And in that process, we're going to tease out what our specific set of character defects, shortcomings may be. Now, the first thing we look at in the workbook is resentment. And resentment is the number one offender. Now, I want to share with you, it's on page 32 of your workbook. Let me just find my workbook here. And it's a great way of understanding resentment. And for those of you that suffer from codependency in Al-Anon and CODA, and I certainly see codependency a lot in the rooms in general in terms of how some people work with their sponsees, I find this matrix very useful. So we know from step three that Bill kind of posits the notion that we are responsible. Our troubles are basically of our own making. We make decisions based on self that later place us in a position to hurt. Our troubles arise from ourselves. So what is he's putting forth that we are responsible, responsible for our illness, responsible for our recovery. So what does a responsible person look like? Well, they're accountable. They're proactive, they're centered, they're leaders, they're functional, they're loving, they're independent, interdependent. And how do we get to that point? Well, I am responsible for myself. When you think about your thoughts, your feelings, your behavior, who's ultimately responsible? You come to the conclusion, it's us, right? And as we know, it's our thought life that affects our feelings and our emotional life, which then in turn affects our actions and behaviors, and thus we become. So when I take full responsibility of my thought life and my feelings and my emotions, my behaviors, and that's easier said than done, but it is a very powerful position to hold when you're in full cognizant control of your own thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, then we can be responsible to others, to be an effective sponsor, a mentor, a leader, a teacher, a parent, a spouse, employer, friend, partner, trusted servant. Unfortunately, that's not the way most people play the game, and I don't play the game like this all the time myself. And I find myself where I'm being irresponsible. And what does that look like? Well, I'm unaccountable. I'm reactive. I'm uncentered. I play the victim. I'm dysfunctional. I'm fearful. I'm codependent. I love the codependent battle cry. I need you to change how you think, feel, and behave towards me in order for me to feel okay about myself. That's an awful position to hold in dealing with the world around me. When I am irresponsible for myself, I give up my power over my thought life and I blame you. I give my power over to you and I blame others for the way I think, feel, and behave. You made me think that. You hurt my feelings. You embarrassed me. You caused me to do that. And I give all my power and responsibility to you. And because that is such a rotten place to be, then I try and take responsibility for your thoughts, your feelings and behaviors. And I try and change you through strategies of people-pleasing, enabling, protecting, micromanaging, manipulation, over-controlling, bullying, martyring behaviors. And those, again, who suffer in codependence and CODA can certainly resonate with those particular strategies. I always know when I'm embodying the character defect of irresponsibility, because when I'm irresponsible, either for myself or to others, resentment is always the result. So if you got a resentment, you know it's tied to the character defect of irresponsibility. And if you can wrap your head around that matrix, it's a great way of teasing out why I'm angry at something. So either somebody's doing things to me that I don't want, or someone's doing stuff that I don't want them to do, and I get annoyed with it and I try and change them. And of course, we're all playing the same game and it's like war out there. And the end result's always resentment. And as it goes on to say on page 12, it destroys more addicts than anything else. And from it stems all forms of spiritual disease. Now, in the big book, they refer to these spiritual disease as causes and conditions, defects of character, shortcomings, flaws in our makeup, the root of our troubles. And I went through the 164 pages of the big book, and I looked for every shortcoming Bill referenced. And this is a list of the words he used to describe some of the character flaws that he had and people that he knew in the original 100 had. And it's a pretty good list. Some of them are a little antiquated now, but it's a good start. I'm not going to go through them. At some point, you might want to go through the list, check off the ones that you seem to have. And it goes on to say, for we've not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. Would you agree with that? And if so, circle yes. Now, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. There is a lot going on in that sentence. We know from our experience that our addiction has a physical component to it. And when we separate ourselves from that physical craving, where we don't act out for a while, or we don't drink, or we don't use, we get separated from that physical allergy. But we know it goes deeper than our bodies, because our minds trick us into either picking up or going or acting out again. But we know it goes deeper than our minds. Otherwise, the psychiatrists and the therapists and the counselors would have resolved our issues long ago. So we know it goes deeper than our minds. And what Bill is saying in the big book is we suffer a spiritual malady, a spiritual disease, which he calls this selfishness, self-centered behavior, where I try to arrange life to suit me. And of course, everyone else is doing the same thing. So the show never comes off the way I want. So as a result of being so selfish and self-centered, I suffer its symptoms and I get restless, irritable, discontented, bored, depressed. That activates the liar. The liar comes out of remission and says, hey, we need a solution. And we go back to the old solution and we succumb to desire again. And once we pick up or start acting out, we're back on another physical spree. So what Bill is saying is that if we overcome the spiritual malady, we overcome the selfish self-centeredness and practice a life of being unselfish and being helpful to others, I will not suffer the symptoms of that malady. I don't get restless. I don't get irritable. I don't get discontented. I don't get bored. The liar stays in remission and my mind and body straightens out. That's the key. And there's a lot going on in that one sentence. It's a great sentence. In dealing with our resentments, we're going to put them on paper. We want to get them out of our head and put pen to paper. And when we put pen to paper, we're going to break it down into five columns of work. So the first column is we list the people, the institutions, or the principles with whom we're angry. Who am I angry at? What am I angry at? Is it a person? Is it an institution? Is it a particular principle? That's column one. Then I ask myself, why am I angry? And this is column two. What are all the reasons I'm angry at this person, this institution, or principle? Then, in most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So I'm being injured in some way. And it goes on to say that we get sore, we get burned up. So on our grudge list, we're going to name our injuries. What was injured? Was it my self-esteem? Was it my security? Was it my ambitions? Was it my personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with? And we get this down on paper and we go back through our lives. Nothing counts but thoroughness, no half measures, and honesty. And when we're finished, we considered it carefully. So I'll go through an example in a minute. Now, the first three columns are pretty straightforward. But then we move to the fourth column at the top of page 13. It says, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. So those first three columns I'm putting to the side, I resolutely look for my mistakes. I'm looking for my own mistakes because when I blame others, there's two ways you can approach life. I'm going to be happy when you change. And how long have we played that game and waited? Or what am I prepared to do differently in relation to you where I take power back? So I resolutely look for my own mistakes. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened? Though the situation not been entirely my fault, I disregard the other person entirely. No half measures. Where am I to blame? Because when we're responsible for ourselves, the only person I can be responsible for is me, my thoughts, my feelings, my behaviors. So where am I to blame? The inventory is mine, not the other person's. And when I see my faults, I list them and I put them before me in black and white. I get them out of my head. I put them on paper and I admit my wrongs honestly, and I'm willing to set matters straight. So what's that going to look like? So I'm going to share the screen with you and pop back to the workbook. And let's scoot up to page 14. So Bill in the big book works out the first three columns, and I added column four and five to tease it forward. According to Wally Patton, who wrote the book Back to Basics, they always wrote down the first three columns, but when they sat down with the sponsor, the column four and five was an oral discussion. I like to put it on paper myself, and that's why I teased it out as a five-column process. So Bill's angry at Brown. This is a resentment. If you look at the second row here, Bill's angry at Mr. Brown. So why is he angry at Brown? Well, he's had some attention to his wife, Lois. He told his wife, Lois, about his mistress, and Brown's after his job at the office. So there's three big reasons that Bill's angry at Brown. So how does that affect Bill? How does that injure Bill? Well, it's affecting his sex relations, both with his wife and his mistress, now that Brown has said, hey, you know, Bill's having an affair. His self-esteem's got to be affected. Around Brown, it might go to arrogance, like, who are you to be messing in my marriage? And around Lois, he's got to feel like he's just, you know, a heel because he's cheating on her. His ambitions domestically and business-wise are being threatened. His pocketbook, his money situation's being affected domestically and professionally. And his security domestically and professionally are being threatened. So what's Bill's part in this resentment? Well, he's cheating on his wife. If he wasn't cheating on his wife, he wouldn't be in the hot water that he's in right at the moment. He wouldn't be angry at Brown for doing things and saying things he didn't want him to say. So right off the hop, you get three character defects, dishonesty, infidelity, and lust. And then the false pride, whenever self-esteem is threatened, it's always false pride. False pride goes one of two ways. I either exaggerate who I am and I get arrogant, or I diminish who I am and I get self-loathing, but it's all part of false pride. It's all half-truths and innuendos that distort the actual reality of who and what I am. I get selfish because it's all about Bill. It's self-seeking. You know, his motive might be he wants more sex, he wants better sex, he wants different sex, he wants, you know, we can only guess at what Bill's motive might have been. Jealousy and suspicion. Irresponsibility because he blamed Brown, and fear. And there's always a fear that drives the character defect. Now, it could be a fear of no sex, it could be another fear, like he's a fear of getting divorced from Lois, or a fear of losing his job. Again, we can only guess, being Bill's inventory. So what should Bill do instead? How can he set matters straight? Well, the way out of anger and resentment is love and forgiveness. And I would also, I should update this workbook and add acceptance. I always find the trajectory is acceptance, then forgiveness, and then love. Honesty, faithfulness, intimacy, humility, to know oneself, to know your strengths, to know your weaknesses. That's humility. Unselfishness, helpfulness to others, trust, be responsible, faith in God, and courage to be the man he's meant to be under God's domain. Now, that's a really specific inventory on one line item. And look at how many character defects we're able to tease out just by one resentment. Now, I'll share a resentment with you right now. I had a, you know, this is a resentment towards principles. And the principle that I got resentful about, especially over these last 2 years, and I've done a number of inventories on this, is I got resentful towards political correctness, woke culture, and critical race theory. Now, why am I angry about those things? Because I think it's racist. I think it's bigoted. I think it's hypocritical. I think it's bullying, unfair, unjust. It assaults the conceptual faculties of the human mind, the human reasoning. It's greedy. It's unintelligent. It's doublespeak, in my opinion. It's anti-life and it's evil. And that's my resentful reaction to those three principles. Now, how does that threaten me? What does it injure in me? Well, it injures my self-esteem. I begin to think that maybe I'm not right, or there's something wrong with me because I think a little differently about things, or I get arrogant and I think the other side is stupid. It affects my security. I get unsure of what's happening in the world. Well, you know, is there going to be a world for me to exist in? It affects my ambitions. There are certain people I'd like to see and certain things I want to do that are being curtailed by these principles. It affects my pocketbook. I could get arrested. I might have to hire a lawyer. It costs me money in terms of, you know, governments implementing these strategies and increasing taxes. It affects my relationships. There are certain people I like to see and to associate with, and, you know, it could affect my relationships. And even with some of the stuff that's coming out, it could even affect my sexuality. So what's my part in this resentment? Because the only thing I can take charge of is me. So where am I at fault? Where am I to blame? What are my mistakes? What are my causes and conditions? So the first thing I try and tease out on my resentment is where I'm being selfish and self-seeking. So it's obviously selfish because it's all about me. But what's my self-seeking motive that binds me to this anger? What keeps my hands around their throats? That's what I want to figure out. So for me, what I'm expecting from society as a whole is I expect that I should have full autonomy, that I should have freedom of association, and I should be free to say and think whatever I want to say and think, to be a sovereign individual. That's not the way societies are working today. It's not the way cultures are working. And it's pretty intense out there. And as long as I hold on to those self-seeking motives and the government's not changing, whether at the municipal, provincial, or federal levels, the world at hand is not really changing in the direction I want. So I remain resentful holding on to that self-seeking motive. And that's dangerous for me because then I suffer the symptoms. I get restless, irritable, discontented, bored, depressed, and then my liar comes out of remission and say, hey, Cameron, you need a bourbon, and then real trouble starts. So I got to see the futility and the fatality and the destructiveness for holding on to those self-seeking motives. Then I look at what fear is underlying this, what's driving it. And for me, it was the fear of authority, the fear of having no control over my life, the fear of my freedom being eroded, and the fear of there's a threat to my life. Now, what character defects pop up as a result of this resentment? I get arrogant. They're idiots. I get hateful. And out of my hatred comes immoral thinking of what I'd like to do with these, you know, individuals that support these principles. And then my mind is full of suspicion and distrust. I get slanderous. I get gossiping. I get dishonest with myself, with God, with others. Here's how I handle the fear of authority. I practice civil disobedience. And in my mind, I think, well, when the government's, I'm going to practice civil disobedience, that'll keep the government away from me. That's kind of a futile thought, right? It just brings them right to my door. Non-compliance. And that brings up a character defect where I lead with the chin. If there's any boxers in the room, if you have your chin up in the boxing ring, you're going to get clocked and you're going to get knocked out. So you keep your chin down. I can really metaphorically lead with my chin by doing stupid things like non-compliance and civil disobedience, expecting the government's going to leave me alone. I get irresponsible. I blame the government. I blame these principles. I play the victim. I get codependent. I'll be happy when they change and they're not going to change. I get intolerant. I get misanthropic. I begin to hate myself and everyone else. And that's a lousy place to dwell. So what should I do instead? I do inventory. In inventory, I discover humility. I understand who I am. I understand my strengths. I understand my weaknesses. I practice forgiveness and acceptance. If I can accept the fact that this is the way the world is right now, it might change, but right now, to accept this is the way things are going. And through acceptance, I can then move to a position of neutrality where I can be proactive rather than reactive, get to a place of forgiveness where I realize they, like myself, are sick too, and then eventually get to a point where I'm unconditionally loving, to have pure thoughts, to trust God. Trust God's got my back. Things are going to work out. To be proactive, to be honest, to be responsible, to be accountable, to have independence and interdependence in my life. How do I find freedom in an unfree world? That's a proactive line of thinking. To be compassionate, empathetic, to be helpful to others, to put my devotion to humanity, be devoted to humanity rather than hating it, and to think critically, to think strategically. I read Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. What a profound influence that book had for me reading during the 2 years of COVID. That came out of my inventory, that wonderful book, and an insight on what I could do You know, Viktor Frankl spent 6 years in Auschwitz facing the gas chamber every day, living on 8 ounces of bread a week. And he managed to survive it, come out whole and viable in that heinous situation, and become one of the leading psychiatrists of the world and developed Logos Therapy. Man, like that, it's a very inspirational book. If you've not read it, you should check it out. And to implement a regime of consistent daily prayer and meditation. And it really, really made a huge difference in my resentment around these principles. So that's how we handle resentment. Now, if you look on page 13, number two, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. Now, we're going to approach fears the same way we approach our resentments. Five columns. We put them down on paper, out of our head, write it down, pen to paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? I love doing fear inventories. That sounds so perverted. I love doing fear inventories because they reveal so much about myself. So here's an example. I have this fear of rejection. Now, fear of rejection is a self-esteem-based fear. So why do I have this fear of rejection? Well, column two, my parents were never there for me. My wife left me. It hurts me when people reject me. People don't seem to like me. So how does that threaten me? How does that injure me? It injures my self-esteem, my security, my ambitions, my money, my relationships, even sex. So what's my best thinking? How do I react? How do I respond to my fear of rejection? I get into false pride. I get into self-loathing. I'm not good enough. Something's wrong with me. Nobody likes me. And it's selfish. My self-seeking motives come into play to be the center of attention, to demand recognition and validation from others, to be irresponsible, to get into people-pleasing and martyring strategies. I get dishonest, I'm full of suspicion, and I have this tremendous fear of being alone. Now look at the man I've created in that fourth column. Do you want to be friends with someone like that? Do you want to have an intimate partner like that? Do you want to go into business with someone like that? I literally create a rejectionable individual. Viktor Frankl, in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, he calls it paradoxical intention, where I literally construct the very person and attract the very thing that I fear into my life. So our book gives us a way out. Instead of column four, how can I set matters straight? I get humble. And here's the paradox too. When we do an inventory, we can't help but live in column five. The very act of doing an inventory puts you into that fifth column. I get my humility by being honest with myself and looking at myself and taking responsibility and accountability for where I'm creating things. And I understand my strengths and my weaknesses. I get unselfish. I get helpful to others. And here's the thing, it's the weirdest thing. Whenever I tried to get validation, recognition, center of attention, it always slipped through my fingers. But when I took on what could I contribute to life and instead validate others, make others the center of attention, recognize other people, out of left field, God bestows all this validation, recognition. I got a reputation that kind of precedes me around the world these days. Not that I ever intended to be anything but a little minnow in a dirty puddle trying to be helpful to addicts, but all of a sudden I've got this global reputation. It's so upside down. It's so paradoxical. To become responsible and accountable, just the very act of doing inventory does that. To get congruent and honest, you have to be congruent. You have to be honest to do a column five inventory and to have trust and to have faith in God and the courage to be the man I'm meant to be. And that's why I love doing inventories. It literally puts me into that fifth column of doing God's will. Third thing, on page 13, we reviewed our own conduct, all harms to others, including sex conduct, over the years past. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Whom had I hurt? Did I justifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? Where am I at fault? What should I have done instead? And we get this all down on paper and we look at it. So, very briefly, if we go back to our column work. Now, a harm inventory is a little different. Now, I always, well, let's take Bill's inventory with his wife that he's cheating on. So, start with the fifth column. So, what is Bill bringing to his marriage? False pride, lust, infidelity, dishonesty, selfishness, self-seeking, inconsideration, irresponsibility, and a fear of, let's say, no sex. Then work backwards. Instead of making column three about you, make it about the person you've harmed. Is he affecting, by bringing these character defects to his marriage, is he affecting Lois's self-esteem, Lois's sex relations, Lois's security, Lois's ambitions, and Lois's money situation? And as a result of having the affair, he unjustifiably arouses jealousy, resentment, distrust, and she felt inadequate. That's the harm done. And what I like about this approach is we see a clear trajectory of how our character defects affect others and what they unjustifiably arouse. So what should Bill do instead? Humility, intimacy, faithfulness, honesty, unselfishness, helpfulness to others, consideration, responsibility, faith, and courage. And by bringing this to his marriage, he's going to affect Lois' self-esteem, sex relations, security, ambitions, and money situation in a very positive way. And it's just might clean up everything that's going on in column two. And thus we see a clear trajectory, a clear correlation between column five spiritual principles with reparations versus the correlation of character defects and the harm that we do to others. I love doing inventories. Remember, in step two, we're coming to believe in a power of greater than ourselves. We're raising consciousness. We're becoming more cognizant of who and what we are. And inventory has a massive effect on raising the consciousness of who and what we are and our relationship with this higher power. I can't say enough about inventories. I remember my sponsor said to me at the end of the 12 steps, he said, Cameron, in addition to working with others and taking these principles in all your affairs, lots of fours and fives and lots of eights and nines. And I've been putting pen to paper for 18 years, and I can't say enough about it. Okay, step four instruction. If we've been thorough, no half measures, about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. Now, that's a relative term. When I work with people, I go for the big resentments, the big harms, the big fears. Get a lot of inventory out of the big chunks. We've listed and analyzed our resentments, five columns. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. Nothing good is happening in column four. That's the bondage of self. Nothing good. There's no power there for me. I commence to see their terrible destructiveness. How do I see that? I see all these inventory items and all these destroyed relationships, and I realize how destructive they are. I've listed the people that I've hurt by my conduct, and I'm willing to straighten out the past if I can. If you've already made a decision, step three, which is what we started this presentation off with, an inventory, step four, of your grosser handicaps, that is the big defects, you've made a good beginning. That being so, you've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Now, note, it's not necessary for newcomers to talk about every resentment or selfish act or each person he or she has ever lied to or harmed for the inventory to be thorough. That's heresy in the rooms today. The objective is to get down to causes and conditions. Sometimes it takes only a few incidents to make clear which shortcomings have blocked the newcomer from an intimate two-way relationship with the one who has all the power. My biggest block to God is hatred. I saw hatred pop up so many times in my inventory, and I got a real clear connection with how vile and how futile and destructive that character defect is. So I work very hard in my day on moving to a position of acceptance where I can find forgiveness and ultimately unconditional love for everything that is happening. I like the Buddhist perspective, to practice loving detachment throughout all my affairs.